step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello everyone, welcome to Struggle Session. Yes, we're back, Leslie and Jack today.
Wow, the classic,
both of us here.
The classic duo, the dynamic duo ourselves.
Yes, sorry, I have been out sick for a bit. Fortunately, I'm still sick, but thank you all, everyone, for all your love and support. It has meant the world, but today I was feeling I was feeling kind of okay, Jack. There's a lot going on in the world of politics and in pop culture, and it's been too long since we've been here to, you know, tell people, let people hear our thoughts and hear the thoughts that they want to hear from us, which are their own thoughts, that all that good stuff, the things that they love from Struggle Session. We can't have you
the thoughts to take on and have as your own, you know, where we've left you all far too long without thoughts to have.
And boy, we got a lot to talk about today, but before we get into that, shout outs to everyone subscribing to us on patreon.com/strugglesession or sesh.plus or strugglesession.substack.com. Also, thank you to all our listeners on the Blue Wire Podcast Radio Network. Thanks to them for all their support. Thank you to everyone who's liked, subscribed, left us nice reviews. Even though, Jack, I have to say, I have to mention this, the latest review, and if somebody could, you know, go back and erase this from the record, don't make this the latest review. The latest review on iTunes, Jack, is a 1-star review for us that says essentially, and don't worry, I'm only bringing this up because people have said the opposite as well, but they said that I am great, but you offer nothing, unfortunately. And we've gotten opposite reviews, so this is nothing personal. But what I want to highlight is, why the 1-star then? If I'm good.
Should be 2.5. Should be two,
two
and
a half at the
least.
Very least.
At the very okay. least. Yeah, well, all right. Well, you know, I'll try my best to offer something this episode. but that is all the way back. That's back in 2022. So we need some new ones.
Yeah, we need some new ones. Get some new reviews in. We should do what the other podcasts do. If you leave us a 5-star one, we'll read it on the air. How about that?
Yeah, we'll read it. We'll do a whole episode reading all the new 5-stars we get.
But anyway, thank y'all all so much for staying subscribed, even though we've had to slow down a little bit. But we're back, and I hope you've enjoyed the episode that you did with Mitch.
Yeah, modern, not scary horror, pretty much. We talked about, you know, Megan, talked about Cabin and Knock at the Cabin. I like Knock at the Cabin, but it is a not scary horror movie. And and Megan, which is both a not scary horror movie and a not good horror movie.
Oh, I dug Megan. I already talked about that on the prior episode, but I actually dug Megan. I thought she slayed. I love Megan. I can't wait for Megan 2. I stan Megan very much.
Megan 2.0. Well, you know, this is me offering something. I'm offering a different perspective on Megan.
Also, upcoming episode, me and Jamie Peck talk about The Invitation, the Princess Harry and Meghan vampire movie. If you have not seen it, I highly recommend you watch it. But here's the thing, Jack, and this is just a problem with modern streaming culture. If you go and watch that movie on Netflix, it's actually a PG-13 cut. It's not the unrated cut. So you gotta go sail the high seas, get them digitally somewhere to get the real version of that movie. That's
Netflix. Netflix is doing the blockbuster stuff now. They're doing the blockbuster 90s thing of putting out the PG-13 one.
Yeah, but that episode of Vampire Castle will be out this weekend with me and Jamie Peck. Thank you all so much for listening. So, Jack, we got to talk about it. The Oscars happened just a couple of nights ago. Did you watch the ceremonies, Jack? I suspect not.
No, not a chance. I like most people in America, will never watch the Oscars again. You know, this is, I'm just trying to be a man of the people. And yeah, no one watches these things, so why should I subject myself to it? I did not catch the ceremony, but I did see the winners and losers, and I actually saw almost all of the Oscar movies, all the Best Picture nominees I saw. There's a couple in the other categories that I didn't catch.
I mean, there really was no reason to watch this year because the best thing that could have happened at the Oscars happened last year, and they're never going to let it happen again, unfortunately. Like, someone just getting straight up slapped on stage. That's great TV, folks. That's not going to happen twice, unfortunately.
Yeah, we will, I predict that we will see Chris Rock and Will Smith together at some point, but it will probably be in a Super Bowl commercial. I think they're going to wait to cash in, yes. And we're going to get some sort of Coca-Cola ad that's about friends coming together, and we'll see them cheers a Coca-Cola or something.
Maybe a Pepsi Zero.
Pepsi Zero. Maybe a Pepsi and Coca-Cola advertisement in the spirit of good friendship.
Did you see the Chris Rock live Netflix special or any of that?
I heard a little about it, and I saw some clips, but you know, I didn't catch the live broadcast. Did you watch it?
Yeah, I did watch it, Jack, and I was really shocked to learn that today, you know, comedy is under attack. I mean, you can't even tell jokes. I mean, I had not heard this before, but Chris Rock, you know, he's one of those brave truth tellers. In fact, you know, they're really kind of, comedians are kind of, Jack, and I hope I'm not being bold by saying this, I kind of think of them as maybe the last philosophers.
They're kind of doing their Platonic seminars. You know, they're out there. They are our modern day philosophers, and it really is a shame that our modern day philosophers are under attack. And it certainly seems that they all are using all of their, you know, highly paid, highly promoted stand up specials to raise awareness about this issue of that they're not allowed to say whatever they want whenever they want.
I mean, I'm really just hearing about this for the first time, except for Chris Rock's good buddy, Louis C.K., who also had a special at a sold-out Madison Square Garden show, which I believe he covered some of these same topics. I think the term is something like a cancel culture?
Won a Grammy for how much he's under attack and not allowed to be heard and everything like that. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I wasn't a huge fan of stand-up before all this, but It has gotten to be just a never-ending litany of TED Talks about the times people got mad at them online, and it is more unbearable than ever to watch any stand-up at all.
Yeah, I cut it off after about 10 minutes. You know, it was just like if you were going to make a parody about what a comedian stand-up special would be, it would be this special. Sad to see, frankly.
I mean, he's a funny guy. I mean, like, Chris Rock, honestly, of stand-up specials that I have seen and enjoyed, like, Chris Rock is a funny man. It's a shame that they're all just completely into this idea of how people are sometimes getting mad at them, and that's the whole anything that Stand Up has to offer at this moment.
The only thing that matters.
Yeah.
Anyway, back to the Oscars. So, big winner of the night. Couple of big winners. All Quiet on the Western Front. People were making jokes because the theme song for it is so ominous. Because it's kind of like a sad anti-war movie. I actually do think that's something to consider when you're programming the show. Like, maybe pick something a little bit lighter from
the score. You know, I do like the score, but it also does sound like a dryer, you know, like a malfunctioning dryer, you know, rumbling around or something. Did you see All Quiet on the Western Front?
No, I didn't. I kind of want to check it out now. I thought it was a TV show at first because it was on Netflix and it was German, so I assumed it was like a extremely overlong television series.
What's the difference at this point? You know, it's a long pilot. It's on a television network. I saw it. I liked it well enough. I do think that like it has some of the best war, you know, shooting that we've seen in a long time. You know, it is interesting to see a modern movie using a lot of practical and mixing in some digital to shoot war. I also read the book this year. I reread it. I've read it before. And there are problems with the movie that I don't necessarily want to spoil for you right now. But compared to the book, I do think it kind of Hollywoodizes some of the story. And what makes the book work so well is, you know, this idea of war as sort of just like brutal but mundane. And I think some of the Hollywoodizing of the plot sort of strips away some of the mundanity of war in the movie.
I often wondered, like, when they're going to make some really, truly gory, brutal World War One movies. Like, I'm assuming that in the show there weren't trenches built up from corpses, and there were so many corpses that the flies covered them and looked like a blanket.
Not all the way there, but it's pretty fucking brutal, and there is a lot of disgusting corpse stuff. And you know, it is about, you know, World War One, and World War One is the most fucking insane and metal war that there ever was. And it does get there. You know, do you care if I spoil just a bit of the ending, or do you?
Oh, no, go ahead.
So what I think really doesn't work about it is, you know, the book is kind of just all about German soldiers and, you know, their day to day and how brutal it is and how they sort of like are, you know, becomes dulled to them, you know. But the movie adds in this thing of an armistice, you know, being negotiated between the Germans and the French, which is basically not in the book. And the movie ends, you know, with this really idiotic sequence where, like, the armistice, they're, like, counting down the seconds for the armistice to take place, and a crazy German general is, like, sending them in for one last battle. And so it's, like, there's this bizarre, arbitrary ticking clock of, like, is our guy going to get out before literally the seconds before the war ends or whatever, because the fighting needs to stop at this precise moment. And that, just in the book, it just doesn't have any of that goofy shit, and the guy just sort of quietly is one of the many millions who died in World War One. Like, we see him go back to his family, we see him involved in brutal battles, and then the book just sort of ends with, like, an epitaph for him. And I really did think the Hollywoodizing of the plot really does make the movie kind of fucking goofy. But there's still a lot I liked about it. Shall we go through a couple more of the other winners here?
Yeah.
So, did you see Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio?
No, Jack, I'm sorry. It's on my list, though. You gave it a very good recommendation, even though people were dragging it. I saw one tweet kind of went viral. Someone says, ain't nobody watched that scary-ass Pinocchio movie.
I mean, I think I did say when we talked about it before that I'm like, I don't know who the fuck this is for. You know what I mean? It's like a little kiddie for adults, and it's also like very adult for kids. But it's a fine movie, and I enjoyed it well enough, and, you know, the big winner of the night was Rick and Morty. I'm sorry, was Everything Everywhere All at Once. Everything Everywhere All at Once took, is now the most awarded movie of all time, you know, one in the actor categories, except for Brendan Gleeson, you know, doing his best. The Clumps took an award there. But the rest is all Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Oh,
the,
Brendan Fraser.
Oh, who did I say? Sorry.
Brendan Gleeson.
Brendan Gleeson, you know, not dressed in a Clumps outfit, but did turn in a good performance this year. But Everything Everywhere All at Once, when I first saw it, I was like, this is like fine. It's a fine movie. And, you know, maybe it's nice to see something that is not annoying to me. Although it was still quite annoying to me. this movie, I don't know. It is the humor in this movie is so bad and so irritating. And I don't know. It is annoying to me to see it clean up all the fucking awards. And I don't think it's that good of a movie. But I do think the Oscars kind of wants to, you know, be a little more crowd pleasing in its decisions. And so I don't know. I knew that it was going to win all the awards. That was like pretty obvious.
You were holding the line on that. People started to waver.
Not a chance. I knew it was going to clean up, you know, for a while now. But I don't know. It's a pretty irritating and like baby adult movie to win all the awards at the Oscars, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I said this on we did an episode on it, and I liked the movie overall, but it could have been a lot better. It should have been a lot better. But as you said, the juvenile Rick and Morty style humor and kind of plot, and just like even the Daniels mentioned that while they were writing this movie, and again, they started writing this movie like over 10 years ago, which is kind of why a lot of the stuff in it feels very dated as well. But they started writing this a long time ago during season one of Rick and Morty. So while they were watching Rick and Morty on TV, they saw that some of the same like plot devices and stuff that they were trying to put in their movie were being done on Rick and Morty. And they were like, well, that sucks. So what was their solution? Did they get rid of the multiverse stuff? No, they just stopped watching Rick and Morty.
I'm exhausted with the multiverse in general. I'm fucking tired of it. I hate the multiverse. I don't think that there's really that much interesting to say about lives in the real world. And everything seems to be fucking hyper-focused on the idiotic multiverse. But yeah, I don't like the humor in this movie. I don't like hot dog hands. I don't like the fucking, you know, statue up the ass, the karate scene. And it becomes so overwhelmingly transfixed with its humor, the everything bagel at the center. And I from the beginning
felt
like... The bagel thing.
I keep forgetting about that thing. Like, whenever I think about the bagel thing, then I'm like, okay, the world has gone mad to make this the most awarded movie of all time, because that was the movie telling you, okay, you don't have to take this shit
we don't give a shit. I think there is interesting stuff at the core of it, and a lot of it is what people talk about. I do like, you know, that it's a story about, you know, people that we haven't heard stories about. I like Michelle Yeoh in it. I like it being a science fiction movie that has as its core a sort of family-based plot, but I do think the Daniels like kind of revealed their insecurity in like relying so heavily on the completely annoying humor and not sort of making concrete decisions about what was going on in their movie. Like, the core of this whole thing is about stupid ass fucking everything bagel and about hot dog finger people falling in love, and I don't know. I find it irritating. It's not a movie I'll rewatch, and I think it's odd in this environment to award Rick and Morty Best Picture.
One movie I end up really liking, I'm not sure if I would give it Best Picture, maybe, but I did like it. Tar.
Oh, Tar. I'm a Tar fan. Tar, I think, actually does fit for me. Like, I don't know if it's my Best Picture of the year, but that's the kind of movie that the Oscars should give Best Picture. You know what I mean? Like, that's vibe-wise an Oscars Best Picture.
Yes. Yeah, so I just got done watching it, and it took me a while to get into. Like, I think a lot of the dialogue, especially early on, not that great. I don't understand what Kate Blanchett is doing early on, because she's supposed to be playing this character who at least certain people seems admirable and charismatic, but I immediately was kind of repulsed by her and everything she says. So
in some ways though, Lizzie, I think that is like intentional. And it's about the type of people she's admirable to.
Yes.
You know, it's like about how the NPR set does find this kind of like, you know, actor, you know, erudition to be admirable.
Like a lizard who's has his skin removed and that was turned into a person. That's kind of what Lydia Tarr is. And that's kind of what, you know, these people like. So the symbolism stuff, the psychological horror images, I found kind of childish and juvenile and not really necessary, like kind of hitting you over the head with certain ideas and themes, not necessary. I would have preferred this film. It was a shorter, more taut, more like a thriller, completely sort of set in the real world. I don't think you need the dream sequences to let us know that what's going on with Lydia Tarr. Like, we see her world collapsing, which she doesn't also have to dream about it too. But you know, that's just nitpicking, really. It still was a really engrossing movie. I still really, really enjoyed it and liked it. I was trying to figure out, because Lydia Tarr, aka Lydia Art, right? And, you know, a lot of people have talked about this movie being about, you know, the art and the artist and how an artist can, you know, be a monster in their real life and how that can bleed into the art. And it's trying to make, you know, this very modern commentary in the post-Me Too world. And also it's a bit of a cancel culture film as well, too. But the thing that kind of it took me a while to get into is because it's about someone that I don't think most people really think of as an artist, right? Like, if I'm thinking of the most artistic people in the world, the most creative people in the world, I would not pick like a conductor as that person. And the movie kind of shows that, because as soon as she gets canceled, she's replaced by like the next dude over. It seems
who were also shown early in the movie sucks and is like, yes, derivative and is not talented. Like, he just slots in easily.
Oh my God, who's gonna conduct Mahler's Fifth tonight in Berlin? Like, no, you just can replace this person. It's much more like academia, it felt like. And I felt like that was deliberate too. Maybe I didn't look up any interviews about what the director of the film was saying, but it seemed to kind of mix those two worlds of academia and art. Maybe that's how the orchestra world is kind of
like that. Yeah, I feel like of any art, it's probably the most, you know, academia-ish. I know that Todd Field, the director, you know, is a fan of classical music and does care about conductors and everything. But also, I do think it's very clearly like a kind of indictment about how goofy the world is, too.
Yes. It just may sound strange when you think about the subject matter. It's very serious subject matter, but it is quite funny.
Oh, it's a comedy. It is a very smart comedy.
It is a comedy by the end.
Yeah, I mean, the ending is one of the funniest ever. The ending is one of the funniest endings, God. Like certainly of the year and maybe of all time.
Oh my God. Yeah, I was actually kind of off put by how the movie was shot early on, because I was expecting it to be a lot more tense, more of a thriller, but it's using all these wide shots and I'm like, this kind of feels like a comedy. It's kind of shot like a comedy. And then by the end, it becomes very obvious, like, yes, this is farcical in certain respects. Some people may say that it might be in bad taste to make a Me Too farce, but it is what it is. And by the end, man, that was ridiculous. That was one of the most ridiculous endings in the world, Jack. And I felt like that was written for like someone like you. Like,
it was
like
truly deeply funny, and the seriousness of it, all of it. I really liked it. I found myself really liking it from beginning to end, and the ending is just really, really is really quite good. And I think does kind of cement it as, in some ways, a comedy and certainly a farce, which I really enjoyed. And I would also say Cate Blanchett is fucking terrific in it. I think she's really, really good in the movie.
I didn't like her early on, but by the end, I really, really loved it. I really, really loved it. I love Cate Blanchett. I think she's a wonder, a dear, but the movie does ask us to believe that she's from Long Island, she's just not good enough an actress to pull that off.
Well, we don't know what Linda Tarr is like. We never saw Linda Tarr, which is fun. Yeah, I really enjoyed the movie. That's one of my favorites of the year. So Triangle of Sadness is an interesting one where this to me, I'm like, is just a broad comedy, the kind that we don't really see made anymore. Like, this is a movie that has probably the best diarrhea scene in it since Bridesmaids. And what I think is funny about it is that, like, it's only thought of as a serious, you know, Oscar movie because the guy who made it is Swiss. You know what I mean? Like, it is like, oh, it's a European guy who made it. And so this is a serious satire. But I've heard people say, you know, oh, Triangle of Sadness is far too blatant and it's not as smart of satire as it thinks it is. And I'm like, I don't know that it thinks it is that smart of satire. I think it just is like a kind of goofy, you know, pseudo class conscious comedy movie that for some reason, you know, I suspect because the director is European, was thought of by reviewers as an incredibly serious meditation. I think it's a great broad comedy, and I enjoyed it a lot.
Well, that was the Oscars. This year, a fairly decent crop of films. I was kind of comparing it to prior years, and pretty decent crop of films. I don't think the right films took home the awards, and there was a lot of stuff out there that I think people just completely overlooked, unfortunately. So some people did say that they thought Tar was a bit boring. If you want something a little bit tighter but with like a similar tone and not a comedy, actually a really terrifying thriller, check out Resurrection with Rebecca Hall and Tim Roth. It's on Shudder. But Jack, were there any other movies that, you know, you thought should have been nominated but were kind of snubbed? People were saying that The Batman was snubbed for cinematography.
Get the fuck out of here. Enough already. Enough. We don't need to take it seriously. I mean, Crimes of the Future was a good movie. I'm not sure if it's an Oscar-y movie.
Yeah, but, Oscars, they would not like it.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure Oscars would do it, but...
Don't Worry, Darling. Is that because you told me about this one? I still haven't seen it.
That's one of the funniest movies. It's definitely not a good movie or an Oscar movie, but it is one of the. It's like it's one of these movies that literally might become like a cult classic. Watch it at midnight, and people like, you know, yell out the lines from the audience kind of movies, because it truly is a very, very funny and goofy ass movie. But no, it shouldn't be nominated for anything. I know the Razzies got in big trouble this year because I don't know. Everyone's fucking, I don't know, the Razzies got in trouble, but maybe it should have gone up for some Razzies.
They got in trouble for nominating a child for, I forget which movie, but they got in trouble for picking on the child, which I guess is not cool. But the Razzies in general suck and are really like uninteresting. Like, you could make an interesting version of the Razzies, but they never do. The Whale, though. Oh, God, Jack.
God,
I can't
that fucking stinks. Oh, my God. The Whale is a piece of shit. Like, on, you know, honestly, Brendan Fraser, I like him. I guess I'm fine that he has an Oscar.
I
have
love
no problem
him.
With Brendan Fraser winning. His performance in this, I'm like, is fine. I think a lot is being done by the Klump's fat suit. So much was made about, like, the makeup, and I think they even took the Oscar for makeup for The Whale. And to me, I'm like, I don't think that much has been we have advanced that much in fat suit technology since The Klumps and since, you know, Fat Bastard. To me, I really didn't see that big a difference, you know, in those outfits. But man, what a fucking piece of shit. Like, story-wise, like, what a horrible fucking story. Honestly, I'm like, it made me think that Darren Aronofsky just maybe is not that smart of a guy. You know, like, I do like some of his movies, but, and maybe some of his movies are, like, in almost, like, the kind of Zack Snyder, like, guy who's dumb is able to pull off something because he's, like, got dumb guy confidence or something. But, man, that movie... Even aside from the sort of fat phobia complaints, which I do think are actually valid, but weren't my biggest complaint about it, it's just this ridiculous fucking awful melodrama that really doesn't elevate, you know, beyond its pretty obvious, you know, themes. Just a fucking piece of shit, in my opinion.
Yeah, real, like, why? Why are you making this movie, Darren? What's going on?
I guess he's been trying to make it like as long as they were trying to make Everything Everywhere All at Once. It was some play that he's like tried to make for over a decade at this point. And I'm like, you know, sometimes like Ahab in the greatest essay that the whale had ever heard, sometimes you need to give up the white whale, you know, in that essay. That was the best one that the whale ever read in history. You know, you have to step back or else you risk becoming an Ahab.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
I will say that I think the whale, because I hadn't read it before, like put the bug of reading Moby Dick in my mind. And I unfortunately, sadly, have to credit the whale with the fact that I read Moby Dick this year. And Moby Dick, that's a lot better than the whale. If you're going to take in one whale this year, read a Moby Dick.
Make it Moby Dick.
Yeah.
That's enough Oscars talk for now. There's lots of new movies out, Jack. Jack, what have you seen lately?
Yeah, I haven't seen a ton. I saw Babylon, which I don't even know if I want to talk about Babylon. That's a last year, so I don't know if we can get into it yet. I've been a little...
No, tell me about Babylon. I started watching it, but I was just like, this is fucking, like, not that interesting. And not, it, like, reminded me of a lot more interesting movies. Like, isn't there a Coen Brothers movie that's like this but better? Let me go watch a Coen Brothers movie.
I think Damien Chazelle is not that good. I'm not a fan of almost any Damien Chazelle movie. I haven't seen First Man, you know, but I don't think anybody's seen First Man. But of your Whiplash and La La Land. So, Babylon fails on a lot of levels. I do think it's like for a movie that is over 3 hours long, I feel like I get close to zero character from it. It's just not good on character. I will say that there's some stuff that almost tricks me in La La Land. That first hour when we're like in the party sequence in the 1920s, and then we see the silent movies being filmed outdoors, I was like, kind of taken in. I'm like, just the spectacle, the circus of all of this. And I do guess, I guess I just like, you know, the 1920s Hollywood as an era. And so I was a little bit interested. There's things, I think it's the best Damien Chazelle. I say that having not seen First Man. And I think it's maybe the one I'm kindest to. But I do think ultimately it doesn't work. And it does this thing where the character in the movie goes to see Singing in the Rain at the end of the movie, and it is not kind to Babylon, because you're like, oh yeah, this movie stole its entire plot from Singing in the Rain, which is actually a good movie. It's like it invites the unfavorable comparison, and makes you realize how much is ripped off. But yeah, I think that maybe Chazelle is like too reverent of the era, and so he didn't make the characters anything more than just kind of like archetypes of the type of people that would be in that era, and I just didn't get any sense of like anything deeper than what was happening to them, like plot wise, and I think it ultimately doesn't work, even if there are some moments of spectacle that did draw me in, especially in the first third of the over 3 hour long movie.
Did you go in expecting to see a clip of Avatar?
I was told about the Avatar clip, and I will say that the montage at the end is truly embarrassing. That is some pretty bad stuff. But I was surprised. I thought I was going to hate every minute of Babylon, and I have heard from people I respect that they like it. I've also heard from people that I respect that they hated it, and I kind of ended up thinking it was a mixed bag and probably the best Chazelle, but ultimately doesn't hold together as a movie.
All right, one I think we both caught, Ant-Man Quantumania, the third entry in the epic Ant-Man saga.
Well, no, let's be fair, Leslie. This is not the third entry in the Ant-Man saga. This is the 31st entry in the Marvel saga.
Oh, my God.
This is more appropriately called Marvel number 31, Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania.
I don't think a lot of people saw this, and I promise you, you're not missing anything whatsoever. It's truly as bad as people say, and I feel bad saying this because the writer of this seems like a cool guy. He follows me on Twitter, but like, it's an awful movie. And the first two Ant-Man movies are like kind of like not grounded necessarily, but like they're superhero heist movies, right? They take place in New York City or wherever Marvel version of that is, right? Somewhat in the real world, and they're just kind of these broad action adventure comedy caper sort of things. Ant-Man and Wasp Quantumania is a Star Wars movie set in the quantum realm. And I mean this literally, and I mean Star Wars as in a Disney Star Wars. You will watch this movie and it becomes very apparent that a lot of the creatures you see, the settings you see, the moving buildings you see that look like AT-ATs, everything in this movie is just fucking Star Wars. It seems like they were trying to make there was a script somewhere for like a OT era, you know, cartoon or something, and they just moved it over to Ant-Man because so much of there is a Han Solo, there is a Michelle Pfeiffer is Princess Leia, like there is a C-3PO like sort of gloopy alien, and R2-D2 like is just fucking Star Wars but with an Ant-Man skin. But it is just an abysmal film, even including that, even though you're watching a fake Star Wars, it's still Disney Star Wars, and it's absolutely awful. It's a really bad movie. I felt embarrassed. No, not embarrassed for the actors. I actually felt ripped off because these are real actors. Like, what you call it? Was it Douglas? Michael Douglas? Michelle Pfeiffer? Is Paul Rudd? I have loved you. I have supported you. I have trusted you for years, decades even.
Evangeline Lilly, whose vaccine opinions I'm a big fan of.
Okay. Like, come on. Like, it felt like someone had taken money out of my pocket. It's a movie that feels entirely like a ripoff. It just exists because they needed another Marvel movie. And there's just nothing about it that feels real or original. It's just content. And it's awful. Truly, maybe the worst Marvel movie. And thankfully, the box office has suggested that most everyone kind of feels the same way.
You know, the level of effects in Marvel movies, especially as we live in now a post Way of Water world, it just is so fucking obvious how much of this movie is shot on just little like green screens. You know what I mean? Like we are maybe for like 7 minutes of the entire runtime in any kind of actual real set. Like, it opens in New York, and then we're like inside a house, and then we are in literally. I thought actually that it looks as though they reused a lot of the, you know, same elements and effects from the other Disney failure, Strange New World. I was like, we're just in a Strange New World. It's like a not so imaginative Avatar, colorful alien planet that I guess is really the fucking quantum realm or whatever. And it just feels so paint by numbers. There's nothing really that like exciting about the design of anything. It looks like, it really looks like how, you know, you used to be able to go to those things at like Universal Studios and they would put you on a green screen and like put you into the movie or whatever. Like, that's what Marvel's really look like to me now. Marvel also has this thing that I think is so funny where all the masks like digitally like swipe up and swipe down. And so they're like drawing the comparison of like, okay, this is a fully cartoon character. And then here's the plate we got of Paul Rudd saying a line. Okay, the mask like slides back down, and now we're watching a CG cartoon character again. And then the mask slides back up so he can say something about family. Yeah, I don't know. The whole thing feels so perfunctory and paint by numbers. And as you mentioned, you know, the reviews were not that good. The box office was not that good. I do think the box office was still good in the post-COVID movies era. And, you know, I think we are seeing a tipping point in Marvel movies where they're not as much a cultural behemoth. You know, there's not as much pretending that these movies are actually good or that these are, you know, the blockbusters that are worth everybody seeing. They're really more of like a
fan.
Yeah,
they didn't give Angela Bassett that pity Oscar, did they?
And yeah, they're really more of like...
And she seemed hot about it, too. Did you see that clip of her?
No, I
didn't. She was kind of hot. She seemed kind of hot about it. I love Angela Bassett. I understand where she's coming from. She seemed a little bit hot about not getting that award, but oh well.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I think that they've become, like, they have... like kind of speed run, you know, becoming comic books again. Like now they're these kind of things that are somewhat popular to the people that really are into them. But to people that are not into watching every 31 movies and all the fucking TV shows and everything, people just aren't going to see them. They're still going to be, you know, big box office movies, and they're still going to release them, I think, literally until I die. But I don't think, like, the next Avengers, you know, with all the also-ran replacement Avengers, is going to get up there into, like, the top 10 worldwide box office. I think for a lot of normal people who are into
fighting
these...
And fighting Kang, yeah, who they've already seen, he already lost. He already got his ass kicked by Ant-Man. How is he going to take on the... Like, who's going to pay money to see him fight the Avengers?
I also
think
this is
a character that started on TV, Disney Plus.
Oh, did he really? I didn't even know. I mean, yes. I can't keep up with it with all this fucking shit. I think that for a lot of like the normal people that were just into the Avengers movies, I think a lot of them were like, okay, the one that had the end in the title was the end for me. You know what I mean? And it's really only like the super fans, of which there are a lot. There are a lot of them, but it's really like a thing for the super fans now. I really think it's very odd that they took the biggest movie franchise that existed and changed it to being like a loss leader for people signing up for their money-burning streaming service. Like, they took this thing that everybody knew everything about, and then they're like, to continue understanding these movies, you need to sign up for the $10 a month streaming plan. And I think a lot of people have just been like, well, you know, I'll check out because, you know, forget it. That's enough. It doesn't have Robert Downey Jr. in it anymore. So fine.
You know, Jack, speaking of franchises that have gone on far, far too long, I don't even know how to say the name. Is it Scream-iv? Scree-iv. Screeve. Scream.
No,
the new Scream.
Scream. Scree-av-em. Scree-av-em.
I went and saw this one because it's a Scream movie. One of my favorite moments, cinematic experience ever, was seeing Scream the week it came out, maybe the night it came out, in movie theaters when I was in high school. Nothing better than that. I mean, seeing Drew Barrymore just get chopped up on that huge, that image will never leave my brain. It just was gnarly. I liked Scream 2 a lot, actually. I remember seeing that one in theaters as well. Seeing Jada Pinkett Smith get chopped up. That really stuck with me as well. The next three, I don't remember anything about, which was a problem for Scream 6 because, Jack, Scream 6... So, you know Scream 5 was about how The Last Jedi was good. Did you know this, Jack?
I know. I've seen it, and I have read the interviews, and I know that it's further litigating about The Last Jedi, which is wonderful to pull Ghostface into it. Fine. Pull Ghostface into the fucking argument. Fine.
Yeah. Fine. Well, Scream 6 is about the characters who survived that movie, which were a lot. A lot of new characters, in fact. Kind of maybe too many for a horror movie. That's supposedly a slasher. They survived that movie, and now this movie is about them processing the trauma of the prior slasher movie. Not just the final girl has trauma. Not just the main character. It's about all of them processing their trauma like it's a prestige TV show.
Or like, man, like Halloween Kills, for example. Oh. You know, almost like this is like the new model for doing like franchise reboot slasher movies.
Of course, there's elements of this in all horror movies, but this is a very defanged, cozy version of it. Pretty much no one dies that you care about in the movie. It pulls so many punches. And the strange thing is, like, some of the kills are the gnarliest kills, but then you're told, oh, actually, that wasn't a kill. That person survived. You know, like, shit like that. And I really want to like this movie. It's probably the best sequel after 2, but I think the main problem with this movie and the prior 3 sequels is Scream 1 and Scream 2, even though they are satirical, even though they have comedic elements, what made them work for me is they more or less try to take place in the real world while slashers mostly take place in their own little isolated nighttime nightmare world, while Scream takes place in like a small town neighborhood and things more or less progress somewhat logically. And as well as Scream 2 somewhat takes place in the real world. It feels like a real campus, a real place. Everything else just feels like it takes place in the amusement park for Scream, which is something you actually see in the new Scream movie. And it just becomes like, it has become a parody of a parody of a parody of slashers, which is really just, and it's not even really slashers anymore. It's just a parody of Scream and whatever hot topic that the director wants to make Scream, pull Ghostface in, as you said, Jack.
Yeah, I don't know that Scream, because Scream in some ways, like you said, does take place in the real world, but it's also kind of a postmodern, like, semi-parody of slashers in general. And, you know, and it really works well at that. I'm not sure that that has much to say beyond here's what a slasher is like and then here's what a sequel to a slasher is like. You know what I mean? Like, yes. I actually get why Scream 2 works, you know, because it's like, here's what happens in sequels. The guy's gonna talk about sequels. But beyond that, I'm like, what happens in the third movie? Like, I don't know. Like, I don't know that this needs to get to 6. 1 and 2, it's like Halloween. You know what I mean? Maybe a 1 and 2 and then maybe a Scream Season of the Witch and then leave it at that.
Absolutely. Well, we'll have to leave it at that today. But before we go, Jack, it is David Cronenberg's birthday. We've already mentioned him on the podcast. So before we leave, what's your favorite Crony movie?
Gonna probably have to go with Videodrome. I think I will.
But it's Videodrome.
Like, but it's up there with The Fly. I'm like, maybe The Fly, maybe Videodrome. But I think there's just more like memorable images that haunt my mind from Videodrome.
I'm a big, big, big Videodrome fan, but sometimes I like Scanners the most. Scanners just is so fun. And it's just like, it's like an X-Men movie in a sense. It like, it's so weird and fun. And the end scene, the fight scene, just impeccable cinema with the music, the effects. I love it as well. Videodrome, The Fly is pretty much a perfect movie. What do you think about what's your favorite from his second half, the serious stuff, and when he gets away from the horror? You know, I guess up until Crimes of the Future, where I guess now he's in his comedy era. Like, he did horror, he did drama. Now he's just going to do like a decade or so of comedies.
Let me see here. Let me try to pull up. I like him obviously as an actor in Star Trek Discovery. Just joking. I'm only joking. I don't like that.
Oh, he's very good in Nightbreed, though.
It is
funny. If you go to his IMDb page, it brings him up as an actor first instead of a director.
Yeah, very funny. I don't know. It's tough for me to say. Maybe like does Naked Lunch count? Is that one of the series? Is that a serious or is that a crazy?
I don't know. It's like on that cusp, right? It's on that cusp. I think maybe Dead Ringers might be the last definitive one. Which they, and you know, they're remaking that as a Prime TV series now.
Why not? Yeah, go ahead. Remake everything.
I like A History of Violence.
I mean, it's a great movie.
Yeah, I actually don't like Eastern Promises. I actually think it's too sentimental. I think he went soft on that one a bit.
Yeah, yeah. I do like History of Violence a lot, too.
All right, folks. That was Struggle Session. Thank you so much for listening.
I'm glad to do another one with you, Leslie. I'm glad to be able to do an episode with you.
Be back in the South. Hopefully it won't be too long before we can get back at it together. But thank you all for hanging on and supporting us. We really appreciate it. Peace.
See ya.
Like what you hear? Want to hear more? Check us out at patreon.com/strugglesession or sesh.plus or strugglesession.substack.com for all our public episodes, commercial free, as well as hundreds of bonus episodes. Thank you to all our listeners for holding us down 5 years strong.